From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh about, as he puts it, Washington's interests in Israel's war. Then we'll talk to the director of an advocacy center for Arab citizens of Haifa and to a Jewish Israeli who lives in an Arab town in northern Israel. She's written a book about her journey across the Jewish-Arab divide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A United Nations-brokered ceasefire has gone into effect in Lebanon and Israel, ending at least temporarily 33 days of fighting. Thousands of Lebanese refugees are now attempting to return home. The UN Security Council agreed Friday to dispatch 15,000 soldiers to southern Lebanon. The resolution mandates that Hezbollah stop all attacks and that Israel withdraw and stop what is described as offensive operations. After Friday's vote, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan criticized the international community for taking so long to secure a ceasefire.
But I would be remiss if I did not tell you how profoundly disappointed I am that the Council did not reach this point much, much earlier. And I'm convinced that my disappointment and a sense of frustration are shared by hundreds of millions of people around the world.
Meanwhile, Lebanon's acting foreign minister, Tariq Mitri, accused Israel of ravaging Lebanon.
For a month now, as the world continues to watch and the international community continues to work, Israel has besieged and ravaged Lebanon, creating a humanitarian and environmental disaster.
Despite Friday's ceasefire vote, fierce fighting continued over the weekend. On Friday, Israel used up to 50 helicopters to land hundreds of troops deep inside southern Lebanon. It was described as the largest operation of its kind since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. A total of 30,000 Israeli troops are now in Lebanon. Israel also continued to bomb Lebanon up until the final moments before the ceasefire began. On Sunday, an Israeli missile strike killed 15 in the southern Lebanon village of Rachef. In southern Beirut, Israeli warplanes destroyed 11 residential buildings. At least three people were killed. Israeli drones also fired missiles at a convoy of hundreds of cars fleeing southern Lebanon. At least seven people were killed, including a Lebanese Red Cross worker. 36 others were wounded. The head of the Lebanese Red Cross accused Israel of breaking the Geneva Conventions by attacking civilians and Red Cross vehicles with Red Cross symbols. The United Nations said Israel bombed the convoy, even though it had granted it permission to leave southern Lebanon. Another Red Cross ambulance was bombed earlier in the day near Tyre. In Saturday, Israeli air raids in Baalbek killed a 10-year-old child and caused damage to the ancient Roman temple of Bacchus. Several stones fell inside the temple complex, which is a UNESCO-protected World Heritage Site. Meanwhile, Sunday, Hezbollah fired more than 200 rockets into northern Israel, killing a 70-year-old man and wounding at least 18 others. Israel said Hezbollah also tried to send two unmanned drones into Israel. Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah said Hezbollah will observe the truce, but will continue to resist the presence of Israeli troops in southern Lebanon.
As long as there are Israeli military forces occupying our land, then it is our right that we face and fight them, and that we defend our land, our homes, and ourselves.
Since the fighting began, nearly 1,100 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in Lebanon. Israel's lost about 100 soldiers and 40 civilians. On Saturday, 24 Israeli soldiers died in fierce fighting with Hezbollah guerrillas who managed to shoot down an Israeli helicopter. The Washington Post reports the fighting has proved Hezbollah is the best guerrilla force in the world. Among the Israeli soldiers killed Saturday was Uri Grossman, the son of one of Israel's most prominent anti-war activists, the writer David Grossman. Uri Grossman was killed when an anti-tank missile hit his tank in southern Lebanon. He was just 2 weeks shy of his 21st birthday. 2 days before Uri was killed, his father, David Grossman, held a news conference along with fellow novelists Amos Oz and Abi Yehoshua to denounce the expansion of the operation in Lebanon. David Grossman said, quote, out of concern for the future of Israel and our place here, the fighting should be stopped now to give a chance to negotiations. Meanwhile, polls in Israel show support for Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's handling of the war is plummeting. 40% of Israelis now disapprove of the war, and less than half support Olmert's handling of it. On Sunday, the Israeli peace group Gush Shalom took out an ad in the pages of Haaretz. It read, quote, a mountain of suffering has turned into an anthill of achievements. Nothing has been gained in this foolish war. Every drop of blood that is being shed now is being shed in vain. At the United Nations, Israel's ambassador Dan Gillerman defended Israel's actions over the past month.
The tragedy we have seen in our region over the past weeks, it tells us, is but a preview of the coming attraction produced by Iran, directed by Syria, acted by terrorist groups, soon to be seen in a theater near you.
On Friday, the United Nations Human Rights Council condemned Israel for violating human rights and international humanitarian law in its military operations in Lebanon. The council voted to send a high-level commission to the area to investigate the, quote, systematic targeting and killing of Lebanese civilians by Israel. This is UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louise Arbour.
Almost on a daily basis, information from the field indicates an alarming pattern in the scale and choice of targets by all sides to this conflict. The deaths of hundreds of civilians in documented and corroborated incidents involving either random or targeted attacks on civilian vehicles or buildings strongly suggest the indiscriminate use of force.
Amnesty International and other groups criticized the UN Human Rights Council for not also condemning Hezbollah's attacks on Israeli civilians. If the ceasefire holds, Lebanon faces a daunting task of rebuilding the country. Over the past month, Israel's destroyed much of Lebanon's civilian infrastructure, including roads, bridges, and power plants. On Sunday, Israeli warplanes bombed power plants in Sidon and Tyre. This is Lebanon's finance minister, Jihad Azur.
We hope that the international community will come with aid and mainly donation for Lebanon. As you know, some countries started, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. We'd expect the others to contribute. This war on Lebanon has to be, the reconstruction has to be the responsibility of the international community as stipulated in the Security Council 1701.
Meanwhile, here in the United States, tens of thousands of protesters demonstrated Saturday against Israel's attack on Lebanon. Protests were held in Washington and San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Orlando. Among the protesters in Washington, D.C. was Miriam Yasmin, a Lebanese-American from New Jersey.
We all here feel that the United States has given the green light for Israel to go into Lebanon without any just cause. They had a plan, the plan's been implemented, and God knows where it will end. And they're trying to separate the Christians from the Muslims, the Sunni from the Shia, and we're not separable.
In Britain, a group of prominent British Muslims, including members of Parliament, have sent an open letter to Prime Minister Tony Blair criticizing his policies in the Middle East. The letter read, quote, the debacle of Iraq and the failure to do more to secure an immediate end to the attacks on civilians in the Middle East not only increases the risk to ordinary people in that region, it is also ammunition to extremists who threaten us all. The letter was sent 2 days after the British government announced it had foiled an alleged plot by a group of British-born Muslims to down transatlantic airliners bound for the United States. Meanwhile, NBC News has learned U.S. and British authorities had a significant disagreement over when to move in on the suspects of the alleged plot. A senior British official said British police were planning to continue to run surveillance for at least another week to try to obtain more evidence, while American officials pressured them to arrest the suspects sooner. The British official suggested the attack was not imminent, saying the suspects had not yet purchased any airline tickets. Some did not even have passports. In Iraq, a well-coordinated attack on a Shiite neighborhood of Baghdad has left at least 63 people dead and another 140 people wounded. The attack began when two car bombs exploded. Then guerrilla fighters fired 9 rockets into the neighborhood. 3 buildings were hit, including a multi-story apartment building, which collapsed. Meanwhile, Baghdad is suffering its worst fuel crisis since the war began. Some analysts say the crisis is so severe it could bring down Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government. And this news from Cuba. The first photographs of Fidel Castro taken after his stomach surgery have appeared in the Cuban press. The photographs were published Sunday, Castro's 80th birthday. They showed him wearing a sweatshirt, talking on the phone, and reading the newspaper. The photographs mark the first hard evidence that Castro survived his recent surgery. In a statement that appeared in the Cuban press, Castro said, quote, "I ask you all to be optimistic and at the same time to be ready to face any adverse news." Meanwhile, Castro's brother Raul has made his first public appearance since he became the acting head of state. On Sunday, he met with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez in Havana. In Mexico, opposition leader Andrés Manuel López Obrador is saying a partial recount of votes from the presidential election has shown so many errors that the top electoral court should declare him president-elect. He vowed mass protests would continue until a ballot-by-ballot recount is conducted. On Saturday, supporters of López Obrador took over several major highways and stopped the government from collecting toll fees. The New York Times is reporting an influential federal panel of medical advisors has recommended the government pharmaceutical companies to begin conducting tests on prisoners. The practice was all but stopped 3 decades ago after revelations of abuse. Until the early 1970s, about 90% of all drug products were tested on prisoners. But such research diminished sharply in 1974 after revelations of abuse. At the Holmesburg Prison in Philadelphia, prisoners were paid hundreds of dollars a month to test items as varied as dandruff treatments and dioxins. They were exposed to radioactive, hallucinogenic, and carcinogenic chemicals. In political news, a former Interior Department official has pled guilty to accepting gifts from Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff and then lying about them to avoid scrutiny. The official, Roger Stilwell, worked in the Interior Department's Insular Affairs Office, which handles issues with the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. The island government had hired Abramoff as a lobbyist. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel and Lebanon saw continued violence on the last day before the UN ceasefire. South Lebanon continued to come under intense Israeli bombardment Sunday. In the most lethal attack, 15 Lebanese people were reported killed after Israel bombed the village of Rachat. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launched more than 250 rockets into the northern Israel. It was the highest number of rockets Hezbollah has fired into Israel since fighting began. At least one Israeli was killed. The past month's violence broke out after Hezbollah captured 2 Israeli soldiers and killed 8 others. Israel rejected Hezbollah's demand for a prisoner exchange and launched a full-on attack targeting Lebanon's vital infrastructure, including power station, the main airport, and scores of roads and bridges. An estimated 1,100 Lebanese have been killed and more than 1 million displaced. At least 40 Israeli civilians have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced under a daily barrage of Hezbollah rockets. The Bush administration has openly backed Israel's campaign. The administration resisted international efforts for a ceasefire and rushed arms to the Israeli military. A major new article says U.S. support for the invasion of Lebanon has gone even further than we already know. That, in fact, White House support for the massive bombing of Lebanon even predates the day the 2 Israeli soldiers were seized. In this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reports Israeli officials visited the White House earlier this summer to get a, quote, green light for an attack on Lebanon. The Bush administration approved, Hersh says, in part to remove Hezbollah as a deterrent to a potential U.S. bombing of Iran. A government consultant said the Bush administration also saw the attack on Lebanon as, quote, a demo for what it could expect to face in Iran. Seymour Hersh is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He joins us in Washington, D.C. His latest piece is called Watching Lebanon, Washington's Interests in Israel's War. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Seymour Hersh.
Hi.
Can you just start off by telling us what you know at this point of what Washington's interests in Israel's war are?
Well, when you say Washington, you have to talk about Dick Cheney. I can tell you pretty firmly that it's his office. I guess you could say it's sort of the home of the neoconservative thinking in Washington. Some of his aides and the people close to him in the White House, Elliot Abrams, David Wormser, others. What I understand is this. Our military, our Air Force, has been trying for a year to get plans for a major massive bombing assault on Iran, pushed through the Pentagon, pushed through the process. And there's been sort of an internecine fight inside the Pentagon over just basically the idea of strategic war against Iran. They're very dug in Iran. The Persians have been digging in for, centuries and centuries. And the Marines and the Navy and the Army have said, no way we're going to start bombing because it'll end up with troops on the ground. So there's been a stalemate. I've written a lot about it. And in this spring, as part of the stalemate, the American Air Force approached the Israeli Air Force, which, as you know, is headed by General Dan Halutz, who's an Air Force, the first IDF commander, the commander of the Israeli Defense Forces, to be an Air Force guy, another believer in strategic war, and the two had a lot of interests. And so out of these meetings in the spring became an agreement, you know, sort of, we'll help you, you help us. And it got to Cheney's attention, this idea of Israel planning a major, major strategic bombing campaign against Hezbollah. And I can't tell you what Bush is, but you have to assume he's right with him. Obviously, everything he's done as makes that clear. Cheney's idea was this, that we sort of, it's like a threefer. We get three for one with this. One, here we're having this war about the value of strategic bombing, and the Israeli Air Force, whose pilots are superb, can go in and, if they could go in and blast Hezbollah out of their foxholes or whatever they are, their underground facilities, and roll over them, as everybody in the White House, and I'm sure everybody in the Israeli Air Force thought they could do, that would be a big plus for the ambitions that I think the president and Cheney have for Iran. I don't think this president, our president, is going to leave office with Iran being, as he sees it, a nuclear threat. The second great argument you have, of course, is if you are going to do Iran, you're going to need you can't attack Iran without taking care of the Hezbollah missiles or rockets. They're really rockets. They're not independently guided. Even their long-range rockets that go a few hundred kilometers, you cannot attack Iran without taking them out, because obviously that's a deterrent. You hit Iran, Hezbollah then bombs Tel Aviv and Haifa. So that's something you have to clean out first. And thirdly, of course, is if you get rid of Hezbollah and Nasrallah, while you get rid of a terror, a man who's considered to be, as somebody famously said, Richard Armitage, the A-team of terrorism. So on that basis, there was a tremendous interest in Israel going ahead. There were meetings. There were an enormous amount of contacts. I should add, Amy, that, of course, and this is reflected in the story, Israel doesn't need the United States to know they have a problem with Hezbollah. And so they were going to do something anyway. But it's a question of timing. And that's one of the big issues. This summer, earlier this summer, there was after the Israelis began their occupation of Gaza, after the first Israeli soldier was captured, a soldier named Galit, I think, or Shalit, I think, June 28th, rather, after he was captured, the signals traffic that the Israeli signals community gets showed an enormous amount of a talk about doing something on the northern border, that is, on the border between between Lebanon and Israel. And so on that basis, it was clear this summer, the next time Hezbollah made a move, and there's been a cat-and-mouse game between Israel and Hezbollah for about 6 years since the Israelis were kicked out or driven out by Nasrallah in 2000. It's been cat-and-mouth. Both sides have been going against each other, nickel-dime stuff. And the next time Hezbollah made a move, the Israeli Air Force was going to bomb. The plan was going to go into effect. The move came very quick. It came about 10 days after, or 12 days after, the first Israeli soldier was captured.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His latest piece appears in this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine. You say the Israelis told us it would be a cheap war with many benefits, quoting a U.S. government consultant with close ties to Israel.
Well, sure. I mean, they believe me, Israel thought, I guess the only other time in history where you can look back on such misguided optimism, or one of the more recent times, was, of course, us going into Iraq, shades of Iraq, deja vu, or however you want to put it. Israel was convinced it would be easy. The Air Force was going to go and clean them out. There was another element, and you mentioned that in your intro and also in your news report. One of the things that that struck me right away, as soon as I saw how Israel was bombing, and my instinct told me there was something there, because in one of the Air Force plans that I knew about but didn't write about, one of the Air Force options for taking out Iran was, of course, shock and awe. Massive bombing, well beyond any of the nuclear facilities. Go hit the country hard for 36 hours, drive people into underground bunkers. Don't target civilians necessarily, but hit their infrastructure, hit the roads, hit the power plants, hit the water facilities. And so when they come out of their bunkers after 36 hours, they look around. In the American neocon view, they were going to say to each other, oh my God, the mullahs did this to us. The religious mullahs who run the country, we're going to overthrow them and install a secular government. That was the thinking for the last year. That is the thinking for the last year inside some elements of the Pentagon, the civilian side, and also in Cheney's shop. So when you watch what Israel did in the opening, its opening salvo, the first targets I remember vividly was, and everybody should, they took out the civilian airstrip. They took away civilian the ability to use aircraft to travel. They took out highways. They took out roads. They took out petrol stations. They basically isolated southern Lebanon. But I think part of the reason they did so much damage to the infrastructure was they believed, and I think the Israelis have been very clear about it, that the Christian population and the Sunni population, don't forget Hezbollah Shia, would rise up against Hezbollah and would be a great feather in the cap, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking to Seymour Hirsch, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His latest piece is called Watching Lebanon, Washington's Interests in Israel's War. We'll come back with him in a minute.
من قلبي سلام لبيروت وقبل للبحر والبيوت لصخرة كأنها وجه بحار قديم
Beirut, Fairuz, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 500 radio and television stations throughout North and South America. We're broadcasting on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM community and college stations, on PBS and public access TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And our video and audio podcasts are at democracynow.org, and our headlines are also in Spanish and audio and transcript form on our website. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Seymour Hirsch. His piece in the latest New Yorker is called Watching Lebanon, Washington's Interests in Israel's War. So can you take us through the timeline as you understand it? That started before the capture of the two Israeli soldiers, the meetings that were taking place.
Well, I don't know an awful lot about it because, obviously, you know, this is secrecy cubed here in this town, Washington, this White House. We really don't. I don't even know how much Bush was involved in the direct planning. Certainly, he's carrying out the policy. The best guess I have is that this spring there was a tremendous fight in the Pentagon over a nuclear option for Iran, with the generals standing up quite a bit against this White House. And I think that's a sign, I guess, of the perceived weakness, political weakness of the Bush administration at this point. And a nuclear option was taken off the table for Iran. Iran's underground, the nuclear facilities, the alleged nuclear facilities, I've also written, but we really can't find any evidence of a significant weapons program. But in any case, they're certainly doing research in Iran, and they may indeed have intentions. But they're deep underground, buried under a lot of rocks, 75 feet, et cetera, et cetera. We've all heard that. And at that point in the spring, when the nuclear option was gone, and there was a lot of concern about how do you drive down 75 feet and guarantee, knocking out a potential weapon system. It was then that the our Air Force began to talk with the Israeli Air Force, because the Israelis have been shipped. We have sent them an awful lot of large 5,000-pound bunker busters, and they've done a lot of research into the idea of using two or three bombs on top of each other, etc. And so the spring is when I began. I think you can really trace the American military involvement with the Israeli military. And as the way it was described to me, eventually this talk, the planning between the two of them, the sharing of intelligence, which is sort of normal. We in Israel are very close. A lot of stuff is shared with their military and their intelligence service. Eventually it bubbled up, is the way it came to me, into the Pentagon, into the top leadership, Donald Rumsfeld, and eventually got to Cheney, whose idea was, let's push this. This is a great idea. I'm not suggesting that Washington forced Israel to go more quickly than it wanted to, but I don't think there's any question that the Israeli Defense Force, the Air Force, was surprised by how quickly Nasrallah, Hezbollah, moved into the business of capturing. As I said, the first Israeli soldier was captured in Gaza on June 28th. There was traffic about going, heating up the north, but for Nasrallah to move on the 12th of July was very quick. But it was agreed that the next step he made, whenever, and I think the best guess people had, it could have been as late as fall, September, October, that they would go. They went quickly. And people I talked with in Israel, I spent a lot of time in this story talking to people in Israel. One of the things that everybody remarked on was the quickness with which the Air Force moved. Not that they didn't have plans in effect, but it was very quickly.
You also talk about Elliot Abrams, and you talk about Donald Rumsfeld's role.
Well, what's interesting about Rumsfeld, because for the first time, and not everybody agreed, but people that, I'm long of tooth, Amy, and I've been around this town a long time, and obviously since 9/11, a lot of people talk to me. And for the first time, Rummy doesn't seem to be on board, is what I'm hearing. Somebody even suggests that he's getting a little bit like Robert McNamara. If you remember McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who under both Kennedy and Johnson was a great advocate of the Vietnam War and its chief salesman, basically, one of its chief salesmen, all during the 60s. And by 67, he decided it wasn't winnable and ended up being shoved out and put in the World Bank. Rumsfeld is very concerned about the 150,000 American troops on the ground in Iraq, who are potentially in a very untenable position. And there's no question Iraq's lost. There's a lot of question about what we're doing in Afghanistan. We're sort of 0-2 in those two. And so Rumsfeld was not happy about this policy, about going in at a protracted war in southern Lebanon with Nasrallah, because, of course, I think Nasrallah is his own man. None of us really know. I think he decides what he wants to do. I don't think Syria and Iran control him the way Washington, this White House, seems to believe everything comes from Iran. Anybody who meets Nasrallah, as I have a couple of times, he's rather formidable. In any case,
Seymour Hersh, when did you meet him?
Oh, I've met him a lot. I mean, I've interviewed him. I've interviewed him in the New Yorker, and I just spent time with him over this winter.
In Lebanon?
Yeah, sure.
And can you describe your sense of him?
I think he believes in he's religious in the sense that I've met religious leaders. Archbishop O'Connell here in New York, one of these people who you really, for an agnostic like me, you come away from a meeting with those people believing that there is something to this business of religion, because these people are so devout. He is very much a believer, Nasrallah, in his own religion. And he doesn't have dead eyes. He's got alive eyes, and he's got humor. And the reason I started seeing him, I see intelligence people around the world, and some of the intelligence people in the Middle East, when the Iraqi war began to start, they encouraged me to see him on grounds that this guy has a better feel for what's going on in Iraq. As a Shia, he was very close to the Shia leadership, to Sistani, also to the Iranians, who have a lot of juice inside Iran. So just as a reporter, I would go see him, and we talk about mostly Iraq in the beginning. And obviously... And in any case, the whole point here is Rumsfeld, to get back to Rumsfeld, there's no question that Iran has enormous influence inside Iraq, dominated now by the Shia Iran. And I think Rumsfeld's concern, I was told, is that a protracted war against Nasrallah will only cause the Iranians, in support of Hezbollah to start squeezing our troops in Iraq. And we're, you know, as I say, it's an untenable position in Iraq, and nobody quite knows. This government has no idea on how to get out, just like I don't think the Israelis win. And, you know, the same pattern you saw in Israel as you saw with this Bush White House going into Iraq. They were so sure of victory that they never looked at the downside. I quote somebody in this article in The New Yorker, a really high-level guy in one of the military services, saying, you can't get this White House to think about the downside of anything. And you saw that with the Israelis. They had no idea once they got into the quagmire of how to extract except to add more forces and increase the death toll to themselves, too.
Seymour Hersh, you've also written about the U.S. rejecting overtures from Syria in dealing with the war on terror. Can you talk about that? As, of course, you can't talk about Lebanon or Iraq with this administration without talking about Syria and Iran.
Well, look, this is an administration that still refuses to deal with people it doesn't like. You know, I don't know. When my children were in pre-nursery, you know, little boys would get into a fight, and the nursery school teacher would take the two little boys who were fighting and say, you two shake hands, and go back to the sandbox, and they would. And so we have a president that won't talk to the Iranians, although they've wanted to, and there's been a lot of stories written about that, and they won't talk to the Syrians. And I've, you know, obviously, maybe not so obviously, but I've interviewed the president of Syria, Bashar Assad, a couple of times, and one of the last times, with great pain, he told me, I think he showed me, even showed me, he was, this is in 2005, he's written letters to George Bush saying, let's get together, let's talk, we have a lot in common, we can help you, we and Iran basically both have more, we can do more for you in Iraq than any other country, why aren't you using us? We don't need a Somalia on our borders, we're not interested in chaos there, and this White House doesn't believe it. And the letters weren't answered, he told me. His ambassador here in Washington, Imad Mustafa, is absolutely isolated. All this talk that the White House has made, Condoleezza Rice, about having openings to Iran, to Syria, are just, you know, they're not worth much. There's been some low-level talk. Nobody's made any effort. Syria, as I've written in The New Yorker years ago, was one of the biggest helpers we had after al-Qaeda struck us, because Syria is... the old man Assad, the father of the current president, hated jihadism. He did not like the Muslim Brotherhood. They were his opponents, and he kept the best books going on the Muslim Brotherhood, which is very closely connected to al-Qaeda. In fact, we learned more about al-Qaeda from Syria after 9/11 than from any other country. Assad, the president, gave us thousands access, agreed to give us access to thousands of files. And I wrote a story, I think, in 02 or 03 for The New Yorker, in which I quoted a senior intelligence official of Israel, of Syria, saying, we're willing to even talk about our support for Hezbollah with you. We want to see you win the war on terror. So it's been an amazingly horrific performance by this White House, which is a par. You know, I don't think any of us, I certainly won't breathe easy until we get to 2009, in inauguration of a new president. But there's just no question that if we were to approach Syria right now, something else I didn't write at the time, that's because I wasn't writing about it, I don't think there's any question that Israel was interested in talking to Syria in 03, even about the Golan Heights, which is a tough issue for them.
Let me
finish this. And we discouraged Israel from doing it.
Why?
I don't know. I guess we didn't want our friends to talk to our enemies.
You wrote in 2003 about the U.S. bombing of a convoy inside Syria that once and for all smashed the attempts of Syria to communicate with Washington.
Well, it didn't really. At the time it did, but there he is again. The president of Syria, Mr. Assad, tried again, and certainly in 05, the letter he sent me, I saw, had just been written. He was still trying to make contact with Washington. Because obviously, in his view, he had a lot to offer us about resolving the crisis in Iraq. And it's a crisis for Syria, too, in Iraq, because there's now 400,000 or 500,000 Iraqi refugees living in Damascus and elsewhere, a couple hundred thousand now of Lebanese. And so a real estate property has gone out of sight there. The irony is that as much as we can't stand Syria, for the first time in their life, the Syrians are getting an awful lot of foreign investment. because with the oil at $75 a barrel, all of the Gulf countries, which are, they're just washed with money. They don't know what to do with the money they're making every day. And they don't want to invest any more in America because some of them have contributed money to charities that have been put on a watch list by the United States. So there's a fear in some of the Gulf countries, if they invest the hundreds of billions of dollars they've collected in Washington or real estate here, they might get put. They might have the property seized for being aiders and abettors of a terrorism. So they're dumping money into Syria right now. They were dumping a lot of money into Lebanon too, but not anymore.
Bob Perry writes at Consortium News that it was U.S. neocons who pushed Israel even further than Israel wanted to go around this issue of the attack of Hezbollah. Do you agree with that?
The Israelis I talked to said, look, there might have been a question being pushed on timing, but Israel certainly wanted to go. Bob Perry's was right in so many things back in Iran-Contra. I just don't have the same information he does on that. But there was certainly a decision that I quote somebody as saying, we told them basically, guys, in this article, I quote somebody as saying, in effect, the Americans telling the Israelis, sooner than later, we want this to happen before this president's out of office. That is, taking out Hezbollah so you can take out Iran.
Just a few months ago, you wrote the piece, The Iran Plans, How Far Will the White House Go?, talking about the U.S. plans to bomb Iran. Where do you think the current situation now leaves the United States and the Middle East?
Well, you can't apply rationality to it because I think it's simply something Bush and Cheney want to do. As I said earlier, they want to take out Iran. They don't want to talk to it. They believe it's the axis of evil cubed, and so frankly, my real worry is what's going to happen. I think nothing's going to happen before this election. That's impossible. My real worry is what's going to happen when George Bush is a lame duck. He's talking a lot privately now, so I'm told, and so I've written about Winston Churchill. If you remember, after leading England to war in World War II, he was turned out by the voters, and he wasn't fully appreciated till years later. So I think he sees himself in the position of, I know I'm right, they don't quite believe me, but I'm going to do the thing I think is right, the right thing, and maybe in 30 or 50 years they'll come to accept me for the great president I think I am. And so that's what we really have as leadership right now.
And where does Condoleezza Rice fit into this picture?
Well, my guess is that she was smart enough to know this last trip she made to the Middle East, I've written that she didn't want to go because she knew she had nothing to offer anybody. And I think there was a story the other week in the New York Times that was clearly she inspired her people about how Cheney's plotting against her. And Elliot Abrams, when he was on the trip with her, he was constantly calling up the White House behind her back and filling him in. You mentioned Abrams. Abrams is sort of the key intellectual player, I think, of this policy that Cheney's involved in. He's not in Cheney's office. He works directly for the president as a special assistant in the National Security Council office. But there's no question his influence is enormous on this.
And Seymour Hersh, for young people who don't remember Iran-Contra, can you just fill people in on who Elliot Abrams is, his history?
Elliot Abrams was one of the key players in this incredibly wacky scheme we had. In the Iran-Iraq war of two decades ago, between 1980 and 1988, Iran and Iraq fought each other, and we supported Iraq. We supported Bashar. We supported Saddam Hussein. The United States did, with a lot of secret arms, secret intelligence, even shipping him secret formulas that could be used to make biological weapons and chemical stuff, and intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. And that was because, of course, Khomeini, we'd been kicked out of Iran when the Shah was overthrown. We were terrified of the Shiite leadership there. And so one of the plans, one of the schemes was, in the middle of all this hostility, Ronald Reagan was so committed to the Contra War in Latin America, that is, defeating what he thought was a communist-led insurgency in Nicaragua in an election there, that he cut a deal to ship arms. It's complicated. They sold arms to Israel, which they were shipped, I think, into Iran. You help me out on this. Anyway, the bottom line was that It was a policy that brought us into contact with Iran, secret trading. We were going to get weapons that were going to, the Israelis were going to buy weapons. Money was going, they were going to sell weapons to Iran. Money was going to be generated from that sale to support, covertly, outside of Congress's knowledge, to convote, support aid for the opposition in Nicaragua that we favored. Not, you know, the...
the Contras.
The Contras, yes. And so there we are. It was totally a crazy policy. When it unraveled, it should have probably led to an abnormal process, an impeachment proceeding for Ronald Reagan. But by that time, everybody understood he was on, you know, he wasn't well with Alzheimer's or whatever.
You think that some of the weapons Hezbollah is using today could have come from that sale from the United States?
No, I think what's happened is, if you really want to know, I think the best guess is, and again, this is, I quoted somebody to this effect, Vali Nasser, who's a professor at one of the Navy postgraduate schools, very, very competent guy. What really probably happened is this. Once we made our move, the Bush administration and the French, to drive the Syrians out of Lebanon, that famous 1559 you always hear about. We always hear about 1559. We never hear much about UN Resolution 242, which called for Israel to go back to its original borders. Anyway, 1559 called for Syria to get out of Lebanon and Lebanon to take control, the civilian government come in and also take and disarm Hezbollah. That was what it called for. Well, of course, it's impossible in Syria because the Lebanese army is probably 50% Shia and very close to Hezbollah. That's an impossibility. Wait, I've lost my track of thought. What was I saying?
You were just saying that after...
Oh, yes, I remember. I'm sorry, Amy. So what happened is, once it was clear that the White House and French were getting our way with the UN... And Syria was going to get out, which could only be interpreted by Iran and by Syria and by Hezbollah as the pressure was going to be on them to be disarmed. At that point, Iran really began to step up its support for Hezbollah. Not so much in terms, yes, there's always been a close support of aid and arms, but they sent a lot of technicians into Hezbollah to help them dig and help them to improve their ability to mask what they were doing, hide their weapons, their launchers for the rockets, go deeper underground, build command and control bunkers, build a lot of facilities that fooled the Israelis' intelligence. The Israelis, some commander units did go into the war early on, and hunter-killer teams, and they were completely bamboozled and hurt hard because everything they thought would be in place was not. The intelligence stunk, and I think Iran in the last 18 months probably played a role in improving Hezbollah's intelligence or its capability to withstand a bombing attack.
Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for joining us. His latest piece, Watching Lebanon, Washington's Interests in Israel's War, is in this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Haifa, the other side of Israel. We'll speak with the head of an Arab-Israeli center, and we'll speak with a Jewish-Israeli woman who's the one Jewish woman who lives among 25,000 Muslims in northern Israel. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to an overlooked aspect of the war as it's affected Israel's northern residents, Israel's civilian death toll is now at 40. But not all are Israeli Jews. Almost half the victims of Hezbollah's attacks are Arab Israeli. They're part of a community of more than a million living inside Israel. While hundreds of thousands of Israelis have taken refuge in bomb shelters, many Arab Israelis say they've had no such protection. They say they've been left on their own, thereby exposing some of Israel's worst inequalities. Jafar Farah joins us on the phone from Haifa. He's the director of the Mosawa Advocacy Center for Arab Citizens of Israel, which campaigns for equal rights for Israel's Arab citizens. And we're also joined on the phone by Susan Nathan. She's a British-born Israeli Jew who lives in the Arab town of Tamra in northern Israel and written a book about her time there. It's called The Other Side of Israel, My Journey Across the Jewish-Arab Divide. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Jafar Farah in Haifa. Can you describe what it has been like for Israeli Arabs in Haifa? And is that the term you use? Do you say Palestinian? Do you say Arab citizens in Israel? What do you say?
We use Arab citizens, but we mean by that Arab citizens and also Palestinians and also citizens of the State of Israel. Actually, we have complicated identities and we have complicated reality. So it's, but don't use Israeli Arabs because we are Arab citizens of the State of Israel and we are parallel Palestinians. In any case, for the last month, it wasn't easy time for us. From one side, we have to suffer from the rockets from Hezbollah, but also incitement against the Arab community that is taking place by extreme right-wing people in the Israeli policy, political system. And also in the media, people in the mainstream media in Israel were for several days they were inciting against the Arab community and the things that were similar to hate speech against the Arab community where, some people were talking in a way that they have to choose they are with us or against us. But in the end of the day, we were more than 40% of the victims of Hezbollah rockets. So we know where we are, but actually some people in the extreme right wing were trying to push us aside and abusing this war to make it black and white, to make the picture that all the Arabs against all the Jewish, and this is not the reality because it's not the way that we see things from our unique place as Palestinians, as Arabs, and as citizens of the State of Israel.
What about these reports of whether you have shelters or sirens?
Yeah. Look, for the first several for the first 10 days, almost we didn't have most of the Arab villages and cities didn't have even alarm system. Until two kids were killed in Nazareth, in the middle of Nazareth. Only then the army offered alarm system to Nazareth municipality. That actually Nazareth, you have to take in consideration, is the biggest Arab city. More than 70,000 people are living in the city, and for more than 10 days they have, nobody was thinking about giving them alarm system that can give them alarm when there is rockets in the way to Nazareth. Most of the Arab cities don't have shelters and villages, of course. Only few Arab villages that are in the area of the border have shelters, but also not for everybody. Almost half of the civilians in the villages around the border have shelters. Most of the Arab villages like Tamra or like other villages and cities don't have shelters, even not public shelters or private shelters. Usually the private shelters for the last 10 years, the government forced anybody that build a new house to build a private shelter as part of the new house. But before that, we had a system of public shelters that the government was building for years in many cities and villages. And for now, we don't have more than 70 70% of the Arab population don't have shelters in the area that rockets actually were killing civilians and were injuring civilians. Now, parallel to that, if you take the media, most of the media is in Hebrew. If you have the three main channels, Channel 1, Channel 10, and Channel 2 in Israel, are in Hebrew. Nobody thought that they have to make simultaneous translation or to make a similar campaign that, like the one that was done in Hebrew, to explain to civilians in Arabic what's the dangers from these missiles, from these rockets, and how you should protect yourself. So actually for weeks, most of the Arab civilians didn't thought that this war will include them until people start to die in villages and cities, and now the shock is huge, and people, you know, like that suffered from these rockets didn't have even a psychological treatment that can help them. And in most of these villages that suffered from rockets, the evacuation of victims were done by private companies that is acting in most of the Arab villages and cities, emergency medical companies that give emergency services on private bases, and they were giving this mainly the saving process and medical support for the first hours.
Jafar Farah, I wanted to get your response to the Haifa mayor, Yonah Yahav, who was responding to Hassan Nasrallah's request that Haifa's Arab citizens evacuate the city to avoid further Hezbollah attacks. Nasrallah had said, "We don't want to shed your blood, which is our blood." This is the response of Haifa's mayor.
Because whatever he did in the last months, in the shallow of rockets he shot at Haifa, caused a terrible reaction and a criticism among the Arabic population in Haifa. The Arabic population in Haifa is very much rooted in the life of Haifa. They are part of the view of Haifa. They are part of the life of Haifa. We, the Jews and the Arab, we embrace each other throughout the last 100 years. This is the only place on earth in which we are exercising full peace between Jews and Arabs throughout the last 100 years. This is the reason why the population remains. They don't listen to him. They won't leave here. We don't want them to leave here. We love them, and they are part of us.
Haifa Mayor Yonah Yahav. Jafar, if you could respond.
Yeah, look, you know, like it's sad because the Haifa mayor himself was helping in evacuating Jewish citizens of Haifa to many places. And in response to Hassan Nasrallah's call, he was calling the Arab citizens not to leave Haifa. Now, we have our trauma of leaving our city. Most of the Palestinians became refugees because they listened to Arab leaders during the war in 48. And to Jewish leaders that called them to evacuate their cities and villages during the war. And like this, as you probably know, they became refugees. And for the last 58 years, most of them didn't came back. So the ones that stayed in place like Haifa, like our family is a family that stayed in 48 in Haifa, like my father part of the family. We stayed in Haifa in 48, and we didn't listen to leaders in the Arab and the Jewish community in the countries, and we stayed in Haifa, and as a result we stayed and we didn't become refugees. My mother village was evacuated forced to leave their village even to Lebanon, and they came back as part of international agreement that took place later on, because this village was evacuated by force. Now, We were very sad because of the call of Hassan Nasrallah. We have our trauma, our memories from calls, from calling us to leave our houses. We don't want to leave our houses. Most of Haifa citizens didn't leave their houses, and people that would leave their houses, they should do that. If they feel like this, that they secure their families, their kids don't have to suffer from this war. And, you know, Sadly, I have to say that the current mayor, Yonah Yahav, he showed irresponsible behavior during all this war. He was calling the military forces to act against Hezbollah and against civilians. And I think the example of Haifa, the mayor of Haifa before 48, and most of the leaders of the Arab and the Jewish community during years were calling for peace and not calling for war and not calling for the Israeli army to use more violence against civilians. The civilians in Haifa, the Arab and the Jewish civilians in Haifa, have the same status of the Lebanese civilians and the Palestinian civilians in Gaza Strip. I would expect Netanyahu and many people in the Israeli side will call to stop attacking civilians if they are Palestinians, Lebanese, or Jewish or an Arab in Haifa. So this is something that we didn't get actually, and sadly, the leaders of Haifa have to think again why they were calling to go on with this war against civilians.
Jeff Afada is director of the Massawa Advocacy Center for Arab Citizens of Israel. As we turn now to Susan Nathan, who's an Israeli Jew who lives in the all-Arab town in northern Israel of Tamra and has written about her experiences in a book called The Other Side of Israel, My Journey Across the Jewish-Arab Divide. Can you talk about the situation in Tamra during this month,
yes.
Susan Nathan?
It's been very tense, very, very tense. I mean, every bomb that is dropped, every katusha, we hear it. And there's been this terrible feeling all the time that not knowing where it's going to land. It's one thing hearing the bombing going on 20, 30 kilometers up the road. This is terrible enough. But also to see and to hear the katushas coming and to hear the sirens going off in places like Carmel, in Haifa, in the Crayot area near us, and not knowing where it's going to land. So people have been very, very tense here. And I, you know, back up completely everything that Jeff has said. You know, the main issue here for us has been totally that we have no protection. No protection whatsoever. I was interviewed on Al Jazeera only 2 weeks ago, and they asked me exactly about this point, and they said, is it really true? And I said, yes, it's completely true. These are people who are discriminated against at every level of life here within Israeli society.
So when you say they have no protection, if you could explicitly explain, are you saying no sirens to alert them, no shelters?
Sirens. I mean, we are not actually a village. We're 25, I think, actually, since the correct figures are actually that we're 30,000 people here, so we are actually a town. We have absolutely no shelters at all and no warning sirens. And I think that that is a disgrace. That reflects very, very badly on the citizenship. On our level of citizenship, and when I say our level of citizenship, how we're valued by the society here, I include myself in that because I choose to live the Arab life here in Israel, never forgetting, of course, that I am still essentially privileged as a Jew here. However, I live an unequal life because I've chosen to live the Arab life. So I live the everyday discrimination in my everyday life, and it has been a revelation to me.
Well, we're going to have to pick up this conversation another day to talk about why you chose, after making Aliyah to Israel, after moving to Israel as a religious Jewish woman, you ended up in northern Israel.
I would like to correct you there. I was not religious. I was simply in love with the Zionist narrative, as many Jews are who are educated in the diaspora.
So
I'm not religious.
We will have you back on to talk about why you chose to live in Israel and then chose to live in the Arab town of Tamra. I want to thank you both for being with us. Susan Nathan, author of The Other Side of Israel, and Jafar Fattah, director of Massawa Advocacy Center for Arab Citizens of Israel. That does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can get transcripts of the broadcast, listen and watch. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Austin, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.